Coming up on This Week on Broadway, we talk with Ben Remmelauer about his show Patty Issues and various different things that are happening in and around Broadway.
I kept my promise, don't keep your distance.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, September 2nd, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this evening, we have Michael Portantier. Peter is away on a much-deserved vacation, and rumor has it that he actually did turn in his book. So hopefully, come Tony season, we will be talking about Peter's book. So, as I mentioned, Michael is on the line. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could also read his writing at NPR.org and Arts America. You can see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
So, it is the last week of summer, and everybody is quiet and getting ready for our big fall launches, but we thought we would bring somebody in to liven up our evening, and we have our guest here, Ben Remmelauer. Ben, say hello.
Hello.
Hello. Ben is a musical theater phenom, we'd like to say. He is going to be at the Duplex doing his show called Patty Issues, and he's got four shows left in September and October, and so far so good. But Ben, tell us, what are Patty Issues?
Well, Patty Issues are all the things that go on in my crazy head as I struggle to find the empowerment in Patty LuPone to get me through life and my crazy family.
So finding the empowerment in Patty LuPone, it's sort of like Patty is an angel on your shoulder guiding you through your day, or?
Patty's the angel and the devil. You know, in my show, I talk about the Evita commercial. There's blonde Evita and brunette Evita. And it's those two sides of her persona that have managed to get me through all the rough and the smooth, baby.
So, give us an example. You know, how does you get to the gym and your favorite elliptical machine's being used? How does Patty help you there?
Oh, James, you flatter me to think I go to the gym. It's more like I'm in line at Dunkin' Donuts.
Okay, you're in line at Dunkin' Donuts. You see Rosie, and Rosie's in front of you. She's ordering everything. And how does Patty help you through this?
You know, it's I think that faced with adversity in all kinds of different times in my life, I felt that Patty just has such a strength. You know, in my show, I talk about that she embodies this sense of deprived entitlement. You didn't give me what is mine. Now I am going to take it. And I think as New Yorkers, we all need someone to help us find that strength.
I sort of feel like you're saying you didn't build this.
Yes, exactly. Go ahead.
Has it been easier? I imagine it's been easier for you to find that ever since her very read-worthy autobiography came out, in which you definitely discuss in the show.
I'm a little disappointed in that book. You know, I basically could have put that book together myself before it came out. I want to know about all the other stuff.
Oh, that's interesting. But I meant the fact that she does tend to kind of portray herself as a victim a little bit in the book, like kind of on every other page, and how she triumphs over all these various kind of assholes who are.
Well, she should call the book All Beef Patty.
Because all she does is beef.
but you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't experience her energy that way, though. You know, to me, Patty. And especially in recent years, it's so triumphant. And, you know, she's, you know, I think that's part of that whole sort of like diva persona. And part of it is the complaints and the victimization, but it's how she rises like a phoenix. You know,
right.
If she didn't constantly bemoan all the wrongs that were done to her, then we wouldn't have the experience of her rising above it. If she just constantly said, I'm a 2-time Tony Award winner, I've never been without a job, I have a beautiful home on the beach, it's going to be like, so what? You know, but when it's like, and then they publicly humiliated me, it always is that sense of her rising again.
Well, I saw the show on opening night. It was terrific. And one of the things that most impressed me was that you were really very honest about it. It's not a, how does that word pronounce, hagiography? You know, it's not by any means a completely praiseworthy of her, although there's a lot of that. But you go into interesting things in her personality makeup. Like, for example, the thing that always fascinated me was how she initially was very supportive and gave the go-ahead to your project that you conceived, I believe, of Leslie Kritzer is Patti LuPone at Les Mouches, in which Leslie Kritzer brilliantly recreated the nightclub act that Patti did back in the day while she was doing Evita. If anyone can imagine that, her doing a club act while performing Evita on Broadway. And it was recreated with Leslie playing Patti and with the original pianist musical director, David Lewis. So anyway, yeah, Patti was originally very supportive, apparently, as you report. And then everything was fine until you decided to record it and then release that. And that did not sit well with her at all. So that really interested me that, you know, that you were able to kind of show the unvarnished truth of that, you know, in that particular thing and other things.
Well, you know, that part of what I love about Patti is that she's always sort of the unvarnished truth. I mean, you know, people can maybe sometimes not like Patti's opinions or the way she expresses herself, but she's never been one to bullshit, you know? And that's part of what the inspiration I've taken from her. And you know, look, it was disappointing to me when Patti no longer wanted us to do the show because I was proud of the work we were doing and we were having success with it. But in the end, I really had to respect her. You know, it's like she said, it's my name, Ben, and it is her name. And you know, the happy ending to it was that I produced Patti's album of her own performances at Les Mouches, you know, which will live on in legend forever.
Right. Yeah, I imagine that she just in her mind, she drew a distinction between having the show performed live and then maybe having a permanent record of it with, you know, someone playing her on it, you know, which does get a little complicated. So I imagine you suspect that was the difference in her mind.
For sure. And also the fact is, you know, I mean, we never deceived her or anything, but I think that, you know, well, in a way, not us, but certainly Patti, when I asked her for permission to do this one night thing at Joe's Pub, I think she thought of it as this sort of one-off, a lark, oh, how crazy, you know, just kind of like...
Right.
I don't think, you know, she anticipated it being the kind of long-running success. And we continued to sort of keep her in the loop as we extended and all that. But I, you know, I think it sort of gradually morphed into something much more ongoing than she had originally envisioned.
Right, right.
So how does a kid from California end up being a big Patti LuPone fan and moving to New York? And tell us a little bit about your history.
Oh, well, I was actually born in New York. We lived here until I was 5. And I talk about this a little bit in the show. I saw a bunch of Broadway shows when I was little. I saw Annie. Not with Dorothy Loudon and Andrea McArdle, but I did see Marsha Lewis and Allison Smith, who I was a big fan of on TV's Kate and Ally, for any of the Gen Xers out there. And I saw The Wiz and Peter Pan with Sandy Duncan and West Side Story with Debbie Allen. And I think I also saw Oklahoma with Christina Ricci. But anyway, I was a big Broadway fan as a little boy. And we moved to California, and it was a little bit out of sight, out of mind, but I have such a visceral memory of seeing those Evita commercials and knowing that that show is considered inappropriate for my age. But, you know, that Evita commercial played forever, even when I lived in California, because it seemed like the tour was always coming through, and they always ran that original Patti LuPone commercial. Right. And so it's sort of, Patti still kind of existed in my world in this sort of peripheral way. And then when I was in junior high and getting really obsessed with musicals in general, I really fixated on Evita and on Patty. And that's when it really sort of became my religion.
Did Patty become your Harvey?
My Harvey? Like my imaginary rabbit that followed me around? No, what are you talking about? Patty's really here. Say hi, Patty.
So where were you living when Evita opened?
I was living on 17th Street and First Avenue across the street from Beth Israel in a building that's still there, Gilman Hall.
Oh, interesting. Because, of course, Evita played California before, played L.A. before
Brooklyn. I was not there yet. Yeah, we were still here. But then it came back a lot. The first national company, I think, was actually a sit-down in Los Angeles with Lonnie Ackerman.
Oh.
But the commercial was Patty. And I mean, the commercial was Patty forever. I feel like it was like 10 years later, and it was like, you know, Florence Lacey was in her 40s touring in Evita, and it was still that Patty LuPone commercial.
Seems like, yeah.
Did you write hateful notes to Lonnie Ackerman?
No, you know, they still wouldn't take me to see it. So I probably, you know, I was 7 years old or something at that point. I probably thought Patty LuPone was doing it at the Schubert in L.A. You know, I probably thought it was still her.
I see.
Face value.
So then you went on to, I'm going to jump from 5 years old to your college days.
Yeah, it was a lot of dark years anyway.
You went to UC Berkeley and you studied drama at Berkeley. And then how did you end up making the jump from coast to coast?
Well, I had actually always really sort of resented my parents for taking me away from New York. And I always wanted to get back here. And my grandparents and a lot of our extended family was here. So we came to visit a lot and would see shows over the years. And then I decided to go to Berkeley for college, basically out of financial reasons, because it was a great school, but the UC schools, not so much I think anymore, but at the time they were, it was a great discount for in-state. So I was very happy at Berkeley, but I was always planning to move back here. And I wound up, what I actually did was right out of school, I did an internship at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton for their 1998-1999 season, before moving into the city officially. But that was thrilling too. I mean, the day I got off the plane, we started rehearsals for Electra, starring Zoe Wanamaker and Steven Spinella and Michael Cumsty and Claire Bloom.
Oh.
And to Broadway, you know, 2 months later. So, I mean, I was just 2 months in New York when I was at tech rehearsal at the Barrymore. So I was pretty lucky to have that experience right away.
Wow.
That's great. And you have turned not only your performances on stage, but also you've directed a few shows.
Mostly I've directed. I mean, this is actually my first time performing, basically. I've done a couple of, for a while I hosted a show, a cabaret open mic at the Beachman called Saturday Night Underground. And I did perform in one incarnation of that award show, You Like Me, where I actually did Patty's gypsy acceptance speech. But all I've done is direct. And when I started out, you know, originally I was an assistant director. I worked for Lonnie Price for a couple of years. This is really my debut as a writer and performer.
You also directed Snoopy with Sutton Foster.
That's right.
And Sutton, has Sutton ever done her Patty LuPone impression for you?
Yes. Oh, she's hilarious. I think she snuck it into Anything Goes.
Yeah. Yes, she did.
Well, I should say much of a large chunk of Ben's show, Patty Issues, is about his experience, first experience working with Patty as assistant director to Lonnie Price on the New York Philharmonic production of Sweeney Todd. And there are a lot of really, really fun stories that go along with that which we don't want to spoil here. But I really enjoyed that part.
Oh,
of the
I'm
show.
So glad, Michael.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, why don't you just tease some of it so that somebody will be enticed enough to come see your show?
Sure. Let's see. It was, I don't know. What should I, you know, I said this is actually a chunk of the show that I do. I'm going to do tomorrow night at XL. It's sort of my director calls it my stump speech. it's a sort of lighthearted little moment. But I guess, you know, I mean, I'll never forget the first day of rehearsal. Lonnie sent me down to the stage door to greet Patty. And I was so mesmerized by her that, I didn't, it was like an out-of-body experience watching Patty get introduced to all these sort of New York Philharmonic people. And it was like, I really was so lost in this moment of observing her that I was like freakish. I had to like snap back into reality when I was actually introduced to her myself. And it will just, I'll never forget Patty's face because she was sort of just like blasé greeting all these New York Philharmonic people. And God knows what my face looked like. I mean, I'm sure I looked like I wanted to eat her, you know? And Patty just like sized me up instantaneously. I mean, it was just so obvious that she just got a kick out of whatever energy I was giving her, you know, because I was just so obviously just in love with her, you know. And it was, she was just such a character in that rehearsal process. It was, I remember sort of psyching myself up before rehearsal started because I'd been so obsessed with her for so many years. You know, she's just a human being. She's not going to be the crazy diva that you imagine that you see in concerts and everything. You know, she's just going to be a professional person in the room trying to prepare her performance, you know. But that wasn't true. She was the diva. I mean, she technically did like concert patter in the rehearsal room, you know. It was, I mean, there were definitely things she said in impromptu conversations in the rehearsal room that I had heard in her concert patter, you know. I mean, it wasn't quite the I Steal Costumes speech. But there was definitely some little familiar anecdotes that were peppered in.
Oh, tell the thing about how when she went over to the window and started yelling.
Oh, God, it's so crazy. This was like very early in the process. And they were in the middle of running through some scene. I think it was the These Are My Friends sequence. And she said, "You can be a barber again. Bill! Bill!" And it was like so crazy because, you know, everybody's like took a moment to sort of look at each other like, wait, there's no Bill. did she think Sweeney was named Bill? You know, what was she talking about? And everyone's looking at her. She runs to the window and starts pounding on the glass. Bill! Bill! And, you know, we were all just like, it was like so great. I mean, I wasn't alone. I have to say that Audra McDonald played the beggar woman in that incarnation. And I actually felt like in a way Audra and I were having a similar experience because we both had been lifelong fans of Patti LuPone and were like forced with this crazy thing in the room of Patti LuPone. And I remember Audra said as Patti was like banging on the window, I guess Audra realized that Patti was shouting at some guy that was walking across the street six stories down that Patty knew and was trying to get his attention. I mean, we were, you know, literally six stories up in the rehearsal room. It was, she had a loud voice, but not that loud. But Audra said, "He can't hear you, Patty." But Patty didn't miss a beat. I mean, it was like, she went right back into like, "I'm your friend too, Mr. Todd."
So Ben, I think I know who Bill was.
Ooh.
So Patty has got two brothers. One is Bobby, who we know is a Broadway performer, and another Bobby's twin, Bill.
And, oh, is that Patty's Harvey?
Well, Patty's brother, Bill, who is William LuPone, was actually my librarian in high school. He actually brought his sister to school one day, and we all got to have class with Patti LuPone. Oh. Could you imagine?
Ben is speechless.
I mean, if that had happened to me, I don't know. Could not have taken it. I feel like I would have just like eaten a desk or something.
Well, My school, I went to a school called Hopog High School. It's out in Suffolk County on the North Shore. And when your teacher is absent, instead of bringing in a substitute teacher, if your teacher is absent for just like a day or something like that, you have what's called Triple E, which is Enriched Educational Experience, where everybody goes to this big lecture hall and a person would come in and lecture you and talk about different things that you wouldn't normally have. And this is when Patty came in. And she did Enriched Educational Experience with us, but like, you know, only the four you know, kids in the theater class had any idea who Patti LuPone was, and everybody else was like, "Who is this freaky lady?"
what period was this?
It would happen whatever period your teacher was out. So she was probably there for two or three periods in the middle of the day or something.
I mean, like
that.
What era?
It was like 1985.
Oh, so we're talking like Oliver Les Mis.
Yes, before Les Mis.
Like she had a mullet.
Didn't we all?
Yeah, but she was a woman, so that's, I guess that's better, right?
Oh my God!
But it was very fun because, like, you know, a handful of us who knew who she was walked in. We were like, and we were like cutting class to go to Triple E. You know, people would cut class to go to McDonald's. We would cut class to go to another class, which is a whole nother be for us. But, but and then, you know, 95% of the students were like, "Who is this lady? Why is she so strange?" And but it was very, it's pretty intense. But she can be.
No, I'm
like,
sorry. Was that before, during, or after A Life Goes On?
Before.
Oh yeah.
Oh okay. Okay.
Yeah, I think it was 85. So that was my, I think that was the first time I met Patti. But
I'm jealous.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't tell you, Ben. I when they decided to release a recording of the Philharmonic Sweeney Todd, the Philharmonic produced the recording themselves, and they made quite an elaborate booklet. Along,
I know, that. Right? It's like
and,
crazy.
Yeah, and they got me to interview the leads and actually some of the orchestra people too. And I remember Patti saying to me that she said that she actually knew several of the Philharmonic musicians from when they had all been at Juilliard together.
Oh, wow.
Even though, I mean, she was in the drama division, obviously, and they were in music. But yeah, but so she said in that sense, it was kind of like old home week, you know.
Mm. Well, she's very old home week about Lincoln Center, you know, everything that goes on there. It's like she's very connected to that space and in that whole complex.
Right.
How did your project come up with reassembling the recordings for her shows?
Well, what happened was when I was Lonnie's assistant, I worked on Sweeney Todd and a couple other things with Patti. And, you know, I think Patti sniffed me out as, you know, definitely one of her gays, at least from the beginning. So I mean, I'm very clearly on team Patti. So we got along really well. And she had hired me to do a couple of video projects for her, one of which was editing a demo reel of her, like her film and television work for casting directors. Another was just sort of doing her video archives. She gave me all her VHS tapes of everything she had of herself from her entire career to just transfer them to DVD and sort of consolidate them and, you know, have them digitized and organized. So that was very exciting because I got all of Patti's videos. You know, I mean, I am like the ultimate Patti LuPone video collection after basically wanting nothing more in life than to be that. So that was thrilling. One of the videos that she gave me was a video of her whole act at Les Mouches, one of the final performances there. And I talk in the show about it, how it was sort of a strange thing because the videos were all sort of like crammed onto these other, you know, people would get 6 hours of room on a tape by putting it in the slow speed or the fast speed. And a lot of it was taped together with like baseball games and hockey games. It was like a hot mess, the stuff she gave me. And Les Mouches was very elusive trying to find it on those tapes. And it would really, I say in the show, it was the holy grail of Patti LuPone videos. And I sort of was aware of the legend of Les Mouches because when I, one of the times when I had come to New York when I was in college, I had bought at the Triton Gallery a fabulous cartoon image poster for her act at Les Mouches. So I was sort of fascinated by that. And I remembered like pulling at the Lincoln Center Performing Arts Library, pulling the Patti LuPone press file and reading Stephen Holden's bad reviews of her at Les Mouches and at the Savoy and just, you know, sort of hating him and wishing that I could have seen Patty saying downtown. What must that have been like? So I was sort of hooked on the legend of Les Mouches. And then it was so amazing when Patty gave me this video, and the video did not disappoint. I mean, the quality is not very good. And people have seen, you know, some of it is on YouTube now, a couple of the songs. But it's amazing. I mean, she's, you know, her energy was insane. It was this midnight show, and David Lewis's arrangements are so weird, and they're this weird world between sort of disco and Peter Allen and Cole Porter, and it's sort of like Bette Midler, and sort of like, you know, it's like just right before sort of the 80s really began with like the new wave and like Madonna and Cyndi Lauper. So it's sort of 70s. It's just so weird. And I love it. I mean, I think that's really where I am pop culturally, is like at Les Mouches. And so it really, you know, spoke to me, and it's I was just so into it. And I had been starting when I wasn't working for Lonnie anymore, and I was directing on my own. A lot of the work that I have been able to get over the years has been directing cabaret shows. And I love cabaret. I feel like, you know, at theater, it's so hard for theater to have an impact culturally nowadays with all the technology and everything that exists. And the theater that does speak to me is theater usually that finds some way to make use of the live audience in the room. And a lot of times that means breaking the fourth wall. And cabaret does that automatically. You know, the performer, there is no fourth wall. They're singing to the audience. And so I've always been very fascinated by cabaret. And I think I began to really use Les Mouches as sort of a model, because I was so thrilled by the work Patty and David had done. And then I just started thinking, why, if I'm doing all these shows, trying to do a show like Patty's Les Mouches act, why not just do it, you know? And to be honest, I don't say this in the show, but Rufus Wainwright had just done Judy Garland's Carnegie Hall show. Mm. And while he didn't play Judy, you know, he just sang her arrangements and her set list. But I think that sort of did give me the spark of the idea, you know. Obviously the Judy Carnegie Hall thing is legendary in a different way, where it's actually known. But I sort of like the idea that Les Mouches act was this sort of like almost like a secret, you know, that people didn't really have any idea exactly what had gone on. Right. And, you know, except for the people that were there, which is a limited group of people. And there was something else about it that was sort of brigadoon-y about it to me. And Justin Bond sort of went into this. V had become a big fan of the show and talked about it as a sort of like this brigadoon thing, and all the people that had been there and then died of AIDS. And there was something very magical to me about that whole moment at Les Mouches that I really wanted to recreate. And it felt like it would be a thing where if we got the right person to play Patty, and we had recreated the exact arrangements and the set list and all the crazy stuff that Patty said. I mean, the patter at Les Mouches was so weird. It's like, you don't know when she's kidding and when she's serious. And, you know, it was all in this sort of weird tone in between, like, being sarcastic and being real. And it just made it sort of very exciting and, like, just out there. And, you know, almost like this weird performance art. And we really took it, I thought that it would take it to another level of performance art to actually have someone performing it who isn't Patty. And I immediately thought of Leslie Kritzer, because I had worked with her a little bit as Lonnie's assistant when he had used her in a couple of readings. And then she and I had been involved in a project with five other actresses called Six of One. Then we actually changed the title to Half Dozen of Another, but whatever. But it was, we were developing this piece ongoing. It was going to be based on their experiences, sort of like a chorus line, but for belters, if you will. But I was so fascinated by Leslie. I mean, in addition to, you know, being a really gifted actress and singer, she's does such wonderful comedic character work. And she's so just unique and just weirdly original and inspired and funny and out there, you know? And I sort of sensed that, you know, she could really sort of zoom in on Patty in a way that wasn't just sort of standard forbidden Broadway impersonation, but her own take on what Patty was. And yet also I knew that Leslie would still be there in the room as Leslie, as a very live cabaret performance interacting with the audience. And to my delight, Leslie, you know, she was looking to do a one woman show. And, you know, now she's done a couple of really exciting things like that. But at the time she hadn't had the chance to write something yet. And I think it was a good chance for her to try being the whole show, just her one woman thing, but without having to write it first. You know, she got to sort of do half of the job to test out that end of the thing. So it was sort of like a fortuitous, you know, we were sort of both had things to gain from doing it together, and we had such a great experience working on it.
Oh, she was just amazing in that. I'll never forget it.
So you mentioned Forbidden Broadway. The new Forbidden Broadway is going to open up, I guess, this Thursday night, but you and Michael got a chance to see it, and without reviewing it, because we wouldn't want to review it before opening, because if we post it on Twitter and things like this, that could all, you know, be a disaster.
I need publicity. What can I want to be like Morgan James. What can I say about Forbidden Broadway that will get the entire Broadway community up in arms?
I don't know. I think she that's a hard act to follow there, Ben.
Oh, damn.
But yeah, the show, yeah, maybe we can talk a little bit about what's in it without
reviewing it.
It did my heart good because they go after two of my biggest pet peeves of the season.
Oh, let me guess.
Yeah, Tracy Bennett as Judy Garland, and also Porgy and Bess. Diane Paulus is an actual character in this edition of Forbidden Broadway, kind of ripping apart the score of Porgy and Bess, and that was definitely a highlight for me.
For me too as well, although I was wondering, when they are open to a general audience, like, are people going to appreciate the Diane Paulus stuff as much as you or I would?
Oh, good point. I mean, it did get a lot of publicity,
That's true.
But so much of Forbidden Broadway is inside baseball anyway. I mean...
Well, and then they make up for it with those, you know, Lion King parodies.
Right.
You know, I guess that's why they have to bring that stuff back too.
Yeah, but they did. There are some older sketches that have not been updated. But then I thought the way they updated Annie was
yes, I was so pleased because I knew they would have to do something about Annie clearly, and they've had such classic, iconic. I mean, I'm 30 years old tomorrow with the cigarette. Yeah. You know, it's almost like, why, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But I mean, I've seen that number for almost 30 years, but they had a totally new one that was so wonderful and equally good.
Yes, they actually used the title song from Annie, which I don't think they've ever used before. And nobody ever does that. And so it seemed so new, you know, even though it's
Annie title song, Annie. Yeah. That's really?
Yeah.
Okay. did they have a Patty section?
Yeah, they did.
Oh, they did? Okay.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit, Ben?
Well, they did the Patty and Mandy show. And I have to say that the Patty and Mandy costumes and wigs were brilliant. I mean, that girl is actually very pretty. And she's in her, like, 20s, I'm sure, that did the Patty. But in that wig, and she has a beautiful body. But in that wig and that dress, she looked like Patty in the Patty and Mandy show. It was so crazy. It was like really mind-boggling. And the whole thing was sort of about how Mandy kept like, just they kept like feeling each other up and talking about like, you know, how much they love each other and how great their chemistry is together. But, you know, I mean, Patty and Mandy really did that a lot, but they took that to like, you know, 250%. And they were just like licking each other's faces. It was really funny.
Yeah, I didn't see that show because it was one of the several shows last season where the critics, journalists were not invited. Because they were considered, I mean, you know, the New York Times was invited, but I mean, the general theater press was not invited because they were limited runs and they were considered, you know, special engagements and not eligible for Tony Awards.
They didn't want to give away the tickets, basically.
Came
down to.
I'm wondering if Frankie Valli is going to do that. I'm thinking he probably is going to not have us.
But I'm sure the Midtown men will invite you.
They will invite us.
So Ben, do you have your Patty? Do you have your Mandy, your muse in the form of a Mandy Patinkin that guides you at all, or is it just strictly
Patty has been both mother and father to me. My friend Randy Blair, who's a really hilarious writer, he wrote Fat Camp and Perez Hilton Saves the Universe. He was supposed to do a show last year called Randy Patinkin, which I'm still really hoping that he does.
Oh, that'd be very good. So, Ben, I'm just going to have to ask you, do you allow people to take photographs at your show?
Well, I hope they will so I can do that monologue.
You're just waiting, aren't you?
Yeah, please. I should have.
You don't have a plant. You don't have a Dame Edna plant.
You know what? That actually is my like least favorite Patti LuPone story. I'm like so over that whole stop taking pictures thing. So I would not have a plant do that. But I wouldn't mind people taking pictures. I'll take any promotion. You know, whatever. I'll take it.
For our listeners out there. Ben's doing his show Thursdays at 9 p.m., September 6th, 13th.
9:30.
Thursdays, 9:30 p.m., September 6th, 13th, 27th, and October 4th so far. So if you want to show up with a digital camera and pop in there and do that just to hear the monologue,
I would appreciate it.
Excellent. Well, Ben, thank you so much for stopping by. We really, really appreciate you taking some time out of your Labor Day weekend to join us and tell us about your show. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you guys so much for having me. I listen to this podcast, so I feel like a superstar being on it myself.
Yes, and I'm planning to go to XL. Is that the name of the club?
Yes, XL Nightclub. We should give it a plug because Marty Gould Cummings, who throws this party Broadway call, has been so supportive, and he needs people for Labor Day weekend. I think they have very cheap drinks tomorrow night. It's a great show. It's hosted by Marty Gould Cummings. It's called Broadway Call. It's every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m., and there's fabulous guest stars. I'm actually like the lowest tier. Usually it's people in actual Broadway shows. And they have an open mic with a pianist, and it's a really beautiful club. 42nd and 10th.
Yes.
So BroadwayCalls.com, is that it?
Broadway Call, yeah.
BroadwayCall,
yeah.
Singular.com.
Yeah.
And Ben, to check your show out, we've sent people over to theduplex.com, theduplex.com. They can find out how to purchase tickets and see the schedule and things like that there. How do we follow you on Twitter and Facebook and things like that?
Well, you can follow me on Facebook/Ben Rimmelauer or Twitter at Ben Rimmelauer. And to get the spelling Patti LuPone style, that's BenRimmelauer.
Okay. That's one letter at the end. A-I-R-R.
Yeah.
Alrighty. All right, Ben, you have a great evening, and good luck on the show, okay?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much.
All right, good night.
Good night.
All right, that was Ben. Michael, he's a ball of energy, and I encourage everybody to get out there and see his show. Thursdays at 9:30. I'm going to try to get out there, but that's a tough one for me.
It's a really terrific show. And what we didn't get a chance to mention is I went to the first performance, and much of it is about his growing up, and a lot of stories, some of them kind of painful about family life. And although mostly about his birth father, who was not present, but his mother and I believe his stepfather and several other family members were there. So, but he did it anyway, and I think that takes a lot of guts, you know. So, bravo to him for being able to do that and do it so well.
Well, it's always so people don't appreciate how hard it is and how much work it is to put yourself on stage. It's so easy at times to play characters, but when you're putting yourself on stage, that sometimes gets very tough to do.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the person, but I've definitely had that experience. I you know, I, in my time in school and community theater or whatever, I was in a lot of shows and a lot of leads, and I felt always comfortable on stage. But whenever I've had to be me on stage or, you know, in front of a bunch of people, it is much more difficult, at least as far as I'm concerned. For me to do a show like this, like Ben is doing, would be one of, like, just about the most difficult thing in the world. And I really take my hat off to people who do it so well.
So just before we leave, we want to talk about Hal David passed away. And it seems like every week we're unfortunately doing this, but Hal had a great life, and he was 91 years old. Michael, you want to say some words about Hal?
Well, you know, it's he only had one Broadway show with Burt Bacharach, Promises, Promises, but that one was really quite significant in many ways. It brought a whole different sound to Broadway, and it's still fondly remembered. And of course, it was revived quite successfully just a couple of years ago. He's most famous for the pop hits that he wrote with Bacharach, and those songs are, you know, just part of so many people's lives. And when you see a list of them, it's kind of astounding how many there were that were huge, tremendous hits. I was reading the list, and for some reason I had forgotten about Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, which I'll never forget. What a tremendous hit that was when it came out, and when the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid came out. I remember, you know, listening to it to AM radio and that song playing, like, it seemed like maybe every 10 minutes. And that's just one, you know, all of the songs with Dionne Warwick and all of those really fabulous songs. So, and he also was a very positive force in the music industry in general, in terms of the industry and encouraging young writers and artists' rights and things of that sort. So yes, that's a great loss for many people.
According to IBDB, he had music in two other shows, Look of Love and Andre Dechille's Harlem Nocturne, which were both musical reviews that he provided some music for. But Promises, Promises, Michael mentioned.
Provided lyrics for it. The Look of Love, I'm sorry, was that the title of it?
Yeah, The Look of Love
was an extremely unfortunate musical review of Bacharach and David by the Roundabout Theater Company. It was, I hate to say, it was very, very poorly done. They deserved something much better, and maybe they'll get one someday. I think somebody should try again, because that one just was, as I said, you know, it wasn't worthy of them.
Yeah. All right. So we'll be returning next week, hopefully full force with Peter when he's back from his vacation. And we will get back to our fall, which is starting in gangbusters. And we have a lot of shows coming up and a lot of news and things that will be happening. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to BroadwayRadio.com. And on that page, there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time you have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded for you. And you won't miss anything. Also, if you could go to iTunes and leave us some comments about what you think about this about these podcasts, would be very helpful to us. The more positive the comments are, the more likely Apple is to feature us in their podcast section, and we'll get more listeners that way. Also, if you want to contact Peter, Michael, or myself, all of our contact information is at BroadwayRadio.com, and you can listen to us through many different ways, not only just iTunes, but you can listen to us through Stitcher, and you can listen to us through Broadway World Radio, who plays us as well. So on behalf of Michael Portantier, this is James Marino, and I want to thank you for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm 30 years old tomorrow, and I haven't worked since I played Annie when I was 10. But maybe there's hope tomorrow. Maybe Mr. Charnin will bring Annie back again. Tomorrow, tomorrow. a sequel like Night